I haven't done this in a long time. Tim does the heavy lifting at this meeting now, but I wanted to introduce our discussion leader because I really think so much of him and love him so much. We got sober together. He's a couple of weeks ahead of me. And Dan, I guess you and Miss Helen might know what I mean by this. You meet a lot of people in the fellowship, but there's something about the people when you first come in that grab a hold of you and encourage you. There's always a special bond there. And I may talk to Neil once a month or sometimes once every 6 months, but every time it's instantly, we're right back. He's always the same. He's always upbeat. He is always positive, a lot more than probably more than just about anybody in ONAA. He's always positive. He's reaching out, helping others. And he works with a lot of new people, and he just does the deal. I admire him. I love him. And I think it says a lot that so many people drove in from the north side on a Monday night, friends of his, to be here tonight. And we appreciate you being here. So I think it's the first time he's told his story like this. But you are at home here. You're among people that love you. And I give you Neil.
And I'm alcoholic. Well, I've actually spoken a number of times, not in a long time, and never about myself. So, and I'll tell you later how I got up here, but of course, Tim Moore is one of the biggest reasons I'm here. I don't know if that's a good or bad thing, but after 7.5 years, I finally got asked to. I think I actually was asked before, but if I was asked, I tried not to hear it, so I kind of ran fast. But when Tim and Tim Ridgway asked me, I thought, okay, this is my chance. So I'm going to pretend that all of you guys, you know, 50 or 60 of you are like my sponsors, so I'm going to go through a fifth step with you and tell you a little bit about, you know, what happened to me. And I think the important part is I was writing down some of these things because I haven't done this, and I surely can ramble on. So at least I wanted to ramble in chronological order. And I started, you know, writing about myself, and I started, I mean, this comes up all the time. I think the important part about my story is it's probably not a lot different than y'all's story. I think you're going to see that, you know, we've had different things happen in our career. We might have had different religions. We had all kinds of different things happen. But I think the theme stays the same, at least for most of us. And, you know, we're just fortunate we have a book study of probably between 25 and 35 guys, usually, something like that. We all come from different walks of life, but it's fabulous. I mean, when you hear these guys talk, they really do have this common bond, this common way of looking at things. And I was telling Dan, who you guys probably know, Dan is kind of well-known around at least the city. And I was telling him and a bunch of guys after the meeting that, you know, I've been in 7.5 years now, and over the last couple of months, I've been doing a Wednesday night book study, and I've been trying to keep up with my kids. And so I come by our Thursday night book study because I want to get the food before Anthony does, because we always have dinner. But I don't always stay. And this last week, I decided to stay. And it was unbelievable. I mean, it reminded me why I go to that book study. Because for me, these are great, these meetings. And in fact, we don't have many speaker meetings at 8111. I like them, actually, but we don't have those. But in a meeting, there's only certain things I can get. And when I'm sitting there with, you know, 20 or 30 or 10 guys or whoever, and in this book study, and ours is one of those pretty regimented ones, but it's I guess at the end of the day, maybe I'm lazy, that I get the book spoon-fed to me, and it's just great. And I know that because this has been beat into my head over the last 7.5 years consistently, almost every week, that's the reason I'm standing here today sober, and the reason that most of the guys in our book study, the majority of the guys who come, never go out. You know, you hear these bad statistics about how people go out all the time. Not in our group, and I really think when I hear that, I usually call people's bullshit on that, because that's just an excuse. You know, oh, I'm going to go out. It's okay to go out this time. They're like, well, I mean, it's your choice, but you know, it took me a long time to figure that out. But you know, I'll go over a little bit about me. I actually was born here. There are probably few in this room that were born in Atlanta. And when I was growing up here, it was actually a small little town. This was actually where I grew up in the Virginia Highlands area. So this was almost out in the country right here. 285 really hadn't even been built. But and as time went on, we started moving out this way. But I was born at 56, so I actually just turned 54 yesterday. And that's why another reason I thought it was kind of timely for me to be up here. And I grew up in one of those first known families of dysfunction and split up, and I'm the middle child, and I just never really remember my father being around a whole lot, except when he would come over to torment my mother or us or someone else. It just with the bad side came the good side. I had a fabulous mother, and I had her parents, were like my parents, and they basically brought me up, and so there was safety because I had them there. But then we always had, kind of this evil guy coming in on a pretty regular basis. And so I just remember growing up, since I was a little kid with fear, which I'm sure a lot of us here have faced fear of something. Mine happened to be of my father and insecurity and things of that sort, but we all had some fear of something. And so it wasn't, I just remember as a child, my mom put us in the car, and we would go drive over to my father's mistress's apartment, and she would sit out there and cry. And there's three little kids sitting there, which surely didn't help for my ego or security. And so I was always looking for something to make me feel better. And remember, this was in the early 60s. So at that point, growing up, I happen to grow up in Jewish, and actually that's another thing about, if you know Jewish people, especially in my era, we were not alcoholics. We could have been drug addicts, but not alcoholics. So I never could get my head around the fact that maybe I was going to become an alcoholic, but we got real fortunate. We were, there's a big synagogue here in town. It's kind of a big prominent one. It's a conservative one called AA, but they didn't take real kindly to people splitting up, nor did a lot of churches at that time. I mean, it just was not the thing to do. Plus, my father was very financially successful, not that he shared any of that with us. So, unbelievably, of all places, the Orthodox synagogue kind of just jumped in. And, I guess a lot of people don't think, would it be someone who was more liberal that would do that? But instead, it was the one that was more stringent who jumped in. And actually, my rabbi became kind of like my father. He was just a fabulous guy, always helpful, always there for us. And so, again, it depends on how you look at things. With the bad that I was going through, I had some great things. I mean, I had people I could look up to, and that happened to be it. And actually, I'm sure you guys know that, a lot of you know that, Jewish people on Friday nights will have the Sabbath and they'll have a little bit of wine and things like that. And I really never had much of that at home. But I do remember going, and I probably was, 5, 6, 7 or something like that. And I can remember going to a bar mitzvah, and there was all of this, this food and stuff, and there are all these little wine glasses around. And I can remember actually drinking those little wine glasses, and my mother found me in the coat closet with the chairs underneath the chairs. Now, I promise you, I didn't even remember any of that until I finally got in the program, because I never thought I was an alcoholic, and I didn't want to be an alcoholic. I thought that was a terrible thing to be, which I'm sure most people did. Of course, today I'm very proud of it that happened. So, outside of the challenges at home and all those kind of things, and I still unfortunately do it today, to cover up those things, I ate a lot. So I was going to start off as a fat kid, which didn't help as well. But I was, even as a kid, I was driven. So 5 or 6 years old, 7 years old, people say, what do you want to do when you grow up? And I'd say, I want to own a bunch of companies. And they'd say, you're 5 or 6 years old. You want to own a company, right? No, I want to own a bunch of them. So I was driven in that way, but then to become bulletproof, I found other things to disguise that, which eventually ended up to be, alcohol. So, I had an older brother, 3.5 years older than I was. So until, the mid-60s, he was around, and then, everybody has their tolerance of what they can put up with. So my brother just happened to not be able to put up with all that pain and stress going on in our family. So he kind of flew the coop. He got a girlfriend. He went off to military. He didn't want to go to military school, but he went off to get away. And so I was kind of left there. And then I had a younger brother, and then a mother. And my grandparents were a little petite. I think my grandfather was all of 5 foot. My grandmother was 4'9". My mother was about the same size. So I kind of, again, all these things are, in my opinion, are chosen. I chose to become the father. You know, I think that, you know, when people say, I had to do this, I learned most of this from Dan. You didn't have to do anything. You know, when you blame things on your past and other things, those are things that you choose. I hear people all the time say, well, that's the way I was brought up, this, that, and the other. Well, let me tell you, my father was, and Tim was just asking about this. I still have that one major resentment about my father, and I think he was a shit. But I did grow up watching him, and I could have been just like him. And instead, I remember in my era, you would watch Superman, you'd find your hero. My hero was Elvis Presley, because he was fabulous. You know, he was fabulous with the girls, and he, you know, he said all the right things, and he romanced them, and he was sweet to them all. And I thought, that's the guy I want to be like. So, you know, I think a lot of it really boils down to choice, which I never, you know, again, until I really got in the program, I never even really thought about those things. I just thought, you know, oh, poor is me. Y'all probably felt that way. Somebody did something bad to me. Everybody's always picking on me, yada, yada, yada. You know, it's just kind of the way I was looking at it. So, in, you know, by the time, in my age group, you know, probably by the time you're 12 or 13, you were experimenting a little bit with drinking. You were also experimenting a little bit with pot. And that's what I started using as my way to escape. And, you know, I wasn't a full-blown alcoholic at that time. Maybe I was, but I wasn't drinking all the time. But, you know, that's what I coped with. And, you know, in fact, I don't know actually what I should tell you guys this, but I'm doing my fifth step. So, you know, my father was, again, I'm not his biggest fan. Fortunately, he's dead. That's why the sun is out shining. But he was, believe it or not, he was, you know, and a lot of attorneys do this. I'm not a big fan of attorneys either. But, you know, he used that power to take advantage of things. And he would, actually, it was very common for him to represent somebody. He would sue the opposing side. Then he'd sue the attorney for the opposing side, because that makes it even more fun. And then when, if he didn't win enough money on his side, then he'd sue his client. So he was winning. In fact, he became one of the largest landowners in the state, mostly by suing people and getting their stuff. He was actually known as, and I try my best not to be known as anything close to this, but he was actually known as the Punisher. So that tells you what kind of guy he was. In fact, one time I was at a closing one time, and this guy started telling me about how bad my father was to his father and himself. And I said, you know, hey, I hear you, but at least he wasn't as bad to you as he was to his own family. He was just a tough guy. I was at one other closing where a guy said, nothing. And we didn't actually, I didn't get back to Atlanta permanently for a long time, because I was afraid, you know, this was going to come up. So I was, so at a closing one time, the guy says, nothing. He says, was your father Marvin nothing? I said, yeah. He said, boy, he was a nice guy. I said, no, he wasn't. He said, yeah, he was. I said, you must have not known him very well. So that's, I'll get past him. But I will tell you, I have my first sponsor, John, he's a terrific guy. And his goal, I think, in life was to get me to give up all resentment. Because, you know, that supposedly leads to us drinking. And there's a guy named Jim Kennedy that many of you may know up at 8111. He's kind of an icon up there. And I actually sat down, John got me with him one day, and we went to breakfast, and we were telling all this stuff, and so Jim, you know, asked what the issue was, and John told him, you know, he still resents his father, this, that, and the other. And so Jim asked me a bunch of questions, and at the end, he looks over at John, he says, just one, it's not that bad. You know, could be worse. So, and I will try to put that to the side as much as I can. By the time I was 16, I was really, I was clearly at home and taken care of. We weren't given a lot of money, even though he had amazing amounts of money. But I did have a relatively secure home. But, you know, I wanted to get out. I was ready to go get a career. So I was really working by the time I was probably, I was working with my grandfather in the hat store he worked at when I was about 12 or 13. And by the time I was 16, I was taking what used to be called distributive education, so you could actually get credit for working. So I was actually, you know, in high school. It wasn't that I really necessarily needed that money, but that's what kept me going, and, you know, because I was always ready to go. So, I was working pretty much full time, even in high school. And, but then, you know, on the weekends, especially by the time I was 15 or 16, you know, I could just become bulletproof by having a lot to drink. And I would pride myself in the fact that I could outdrink almost anybody I know. And even though I'm big, believe me, I wasn't as big as my friends. In fact, most of my friends were huge. And I was the guy that's the thinner guy. I was probably 165, 70 pounds at the time, which was a lot of weight before this. And I would stand in the middle. You know, we got all those big guys. And I would be the one in the middle going, "You son of a bitch, is that?" Because I knew they couldn't get me, you know, because I stand between all my buddies. But, you know, I would out, especially chugging what became my big deal, and I could out chug anybody, which I don't know how anybody could actually think that's a cool thing, but I was very proud of it for the longest time. So basically in 74, I graduated from high school and went off to Georgia. And, you know, again, very insecure, forcing by that time. I'd lost a lot of weight, so things were much better with the ladies. And in fact, you know, most of my life, even my, many of my, up until, truthfully, up until I got in AA and I got in a men's group, my best friends were always girls, because especially as a young kid, the boys wouldn't play with me because I was fat, and the girls would because I was fat and I wasn't going to get in their pants or anything else, and I was safe, you know, so I could just hang with them. So I had girlfriends, you know, most of my life. And also, you know, truthfully, I used to say, and I still believe it today, that I'm a, you know, that I'm a female chauvinist pig, because I saw how poorly my mother was treated in the 60s and 70s, and back in those days, you know, the male spouse could surely, especially financially, take advantage of them. So, you know, the husband could have millions and millions and millions of dollars, and the wife could end up with zero or less than zero. So, you know, I always gravitated towards women, and you know, and maybe because I always felt like I was insecure, and I knew a lot of women weren't being treated well, so, you know, I became really close with women. But again, if I knew somebody, it was easy, but if I were to go to a bar or whatever else, I just didn't have that gift of gab. So, you know, get as looped as you possibly can. And then, truth, I wasn't even good then, but I had friends that were good. In fact, I mean, I will tell you, you know, I like a lot of guys, especially during my drinking days, would go to, you know, the strip bars and this, that, and the other. But the chances of me meeting someone there, like, zero. Because, you know, I'd be so sloshed every time I go there. I don't think I ever went anywhere where I wouldn't drink first. I don't know if you guys did that, but I wasn't going to go out and spend a bunch of money for a bunch of alcohol. I would go get a bunch of cheap beer and chug it all down before I get there. And then, you know, you go to those places, whether it's a regular bar or a strip bar or whatever else, you know, the people that are attractive are the ones that are secure with themselves. Well, I wasn't secure. And on top of it, by that time, I got, you know, drool hanging down my mouth. You know, I'm the guy they run away from because I just wasn't, you know, I was all, it didn't, I thought that the alcohol was covering up things, but it wasn't covering up anything. In the 70s, for those who remember back that far, that's when Miller Lite came out. So that was perfect for me, because by that time I was thin. I wasn't eating very much. I was a big runner and things of that sort. I was actually, believe it or not, a triathlete. And so it was great. I could eat very little. I could drink tons of Miller Lite because it was only whatever many 96 calories or whatever it was. And, you know, and that's what I would do. I mean, I was big, you know, on the athletic side doing that. But that would mean I wouldn't have a six-pack before I'd even go run. I mean, whatever it was, so I was staying fit, and I was thinking, okay, you're doing the right thing. You know, you're not hurting anybody. It's you can run far. You're not going to gain any weight. And, of course, no matter what you think and no matter how driven you are and how many, this is the worst part, how many God-given talents you've been given, when you're sloshed, it's hard to do, you know, to always perform at your top, even though I thought I did many times. So basically, 78, I graduated, came back to Atlanta, and fortunately, and actually during high school and stuff, I told you I wanted to own a company, so I did. My best friend and I owned some company, owned a couple little companies, vending businesses. We grew real big. We sold them after college, and then I went to work for the mortgage side of a bank called First Union National Bank, which became Marconi. So, and fortunately, I excelled there. I did really well, still, again, drinking too much, especially on the weekends. But I did really well there. But, you know, I don't care how bad a parent is to you. Children, at least they think they need their parents. So eventually I went to my father, even though I didn't have much of a relationship with him, and he offered me a position to go work with him. So I left this really good job to go work with him, and that was like the craziest thing in the world. I mean, you know, for someone who really wasn't good to you or your family, but you're trying to be that peacekeeper, you know, between your mother, your father, all this stuff. So anyway, I went there. Well, actually probably less than a year from that that time, he fired me. So I ended up canned, probably deserved it, but it just was terrible. And then I think once again, as many times in my life, God stepped in. And I'm going to probably mention God a lot now. You probably won't meet a lot of Jewish people for some reason don't mention God a lot, but though I think most that I know are very, you know, believe in God, but it's something I guess a lot of Jewish people don't wear on their sleeve. I've been fortunate enough that God just, you know, over the last number of years, I've realized that, yes, there's a God, and too many things are coincidental. I mean, sometimes the most unlucky guy, but sometimes the luckiest guy. So I've come to call that luck God, and I've come to call the bad things shit happens. I don't say God made it happen, somebody else made it happen. You know, life happens. And, you know, if you got to give credit to somebody, I'd rather not give it to me, so let's pass it to God. So that's kind of how I look at things at this point. Anyway, as time went on, I went back to the bank, and I was actually very fortunate and got like this killer job. The chairman of the bank was the youngest chairman of the bank ever, and of a national bank. And his first job at the bank was a bond trader. And guess what? Here I was in Atlanta, and they said, come up to Charlotte and you can be a bond trader. So you couldn't ask for a better opportunity. That was the plum job. Of course, I got up there, and you know, by that time I was drinking pretty good. And even though I spent 10 years there and built a lot of different divisions and other things for them, clearly the thing that continued to hold me back was my drinking. Now, I don't know who knew I was drinking, who didn't know I was drinking, but you know, you do it long enough and you do it on a regular basis. I mean, some people have said, you know, I know during different jobs they've thought, do you have a mental illness, which actually runs in our family, or something. So people, you know, for those of us who think we're sitting out there, you know, drinking or drugging or whatever else and nobody notices, but they do notice. They may not know that you were drunk, but they know something is wrong with you. I mean, Dan's told that story before about himself and the years that he spent in a big company. And, you know, they just know something is wrong. So, again, I'm trying to, you know, talk about not just me but and what happened in my career and my life. But I think, you know, as you look upon your own, no matter whether you, you know, whatever you did, I think there's just a lot of commonality that I meet, at least with the majority of my friends. We've all kind of been down, you know, something similar. Anyway, in 74... I got married to this great girl. She had actually been married previously to an alcoholic. She had two parents who were alcoholics. And she married me. And after a while, she decided I was an alcoholic. Now, of course, I was not an alcoholic. We all know that. So, but, you know, I really loved her. She was a great girl. And so she asked me to join AA. So I did. So from 84 to 85, I was in an AA. I never worked the program. I did find a sponsor because I thought he'd help me with my career, which didn't quite work out that way. But and for one full year, I did not drink. And then after that, probably the day of that full year, I said, see, I don't have a problem. And then I went out drinking again. Now, you know, during all that, I mean, this is what's so just amazing is that there I was drinking, you know, most of my life. And during that same time, I got, I started the investment bank for the bank. I got in the executive MBA program at Wake Forest, and so I was doing that. I started something called the Metro Atlanta Entrepreneurial Council. I got married. Had all these great things going on, but you know, I've heard a lot of people say sometimes a lot of alcoholics are just overperformers, overachievers, trying to do all these things, in many part probably to make up for our own insecurities. And so I was always doing all these things, but you know, some way or another, I was always drinking as well, which you know, doesn't always fit well together. In any event, so I told you I went back out in 85. So don't forget that date because that was a long time ago. In any event, by 89, I had, you know, basically let drink really take over my life. There were a lot of family challenges still going on. Even though my mother and father were divorced by that time, I truly believe my father just relished in tormenting my mother. So by 89, he had tormented her enough that she committed suicide. And my younger brother, who always had some issues, found her and was then diagnosed, but he had to go in the mental hospital and he ended up having paranoid schizophrenia. So I'm sitting in Charlotte, my family's sitting here in Atlanta, part of them. I'm trying to manage all this stuff. My older brother, as I told you, he flew the coop because he couldn't handle the pressure, which is okay. So in any event, things started going really downhill fast, and then my first wife was smart enough to hit the road. In fact, I'm very close with her mother even to this day. She still says I'm her favorite son-in-law. But you know, she couldn't put up with it, and I don't blame her. I mean, I was a mess. And I was, just like I'm sure a lot of you guys, I got consumed with things. I was consumed with now managing my mother's estate, and I was consumed with helping my brother, and by that time I'd left the bank, and so there's no income coming in, and it's just a mess. And that was my life for the majority of my life. It was up and down, and I don't know if you guys remember, I think it was in Driving Miss Daisy, but the lady there said that, you know, a lot of the other kids when she was growing up liked the merry-go-round because it went round and round and round, but she liked the roller coaster because it went up and down and up and I used to proudly tell people, that's who I'm like. Well, let me just say, from my perspective, that's how my life was. It was always big highs and big lows, and I mean extreme ones, which can not only tear you apart, but it tears all of your family apart when they have to put up with that. So fortunately, Karen got smart and hit the road. So by that time, I'm still living up there. I have no income coming in, all this kind of stuff, and deeply depressed. And we do have a lot of depression in our family and mental illness in our family. So I get fortunate again, and I go to Jewish Family Services. And by that time, I, you know, don't feel like I can afford anything, and so they take me to try to help me. And then so I got no income, I'm trying to do all these kind of things, and the lady there says, "You know what you need to do? You need to start volunteering and helping people out." I'm like, what the hell are you talking about? They need to be helping me out. I'm the one who has all this stuff going on. I'm not going to do that. And she's like, "No, Neil, you need to start helping people out." So I said, "Okay, what would you suggest?" So now remember, before I left the bank, at least in my own head, I was a big shot. I started a bunch of things. A lot of people knew me. I started this group, the Metron Entrepreneurial Council. I mean, I was at least somewhat of a recognizable name, and now I'm sitting there with no income. And she says, "Look, there are all these Jewish immigrants that have come over from Russia. They have nothing. We're putting them up in some apartments, and what we'd like you to do is go drive the bus to go pick them up." I'm thinking, there ain't no damn way I'm going to be driving that bus. So some way or another, I'm sure it was God said, "Okay, you need to go do this." So I can remember, in Charlotte, they actually have this tremendous center up there. So I parked my car as far away from that bus as I possibly could, and then I snuck over to that bus to drive. It's one of these mini buses, but it's still one you had to look down and open the door. And I'm sitting there, I remember getting in there thinking, I mean, I thought I was going to start crying because my life was just in shambles, and I thought I was a big shot. Now I'm driving this bus. So, but the best part, again, God jumped in. I'm driving the bus. I go to pick these folks up. I open the door. There's this elderly guy, no hair, not a bunch of teeth, striped shirt, plaid pants, his family with him. They look about the same, you know, all, you know, little kids and this and there. And he looks up. They couldn't say a word of English. Big smile, no teeth. And they're like, "Thank you." And I'm thinking, God, you know, I'm driving the bus. They're sitting there. I think I've got it so bad. I was just telling Tim, we were coming back from dinner. We're talking about, because, you know, you'll hear in a little bit, I'm still having some challenges at this point. But we're driving here, and we see a guy walking with his cane, walking up the street. And I'm thinking, Tim and I are driving in this car. We can see, you know, we have all these great things. And so, you know, it's just very interesting how we oftentimes don't count our blessings. Tim said something I had not thought about or heard in a long time. He said, "You know, we live in paradise here. We live in the Garden of Eden. We're here in the United States. In a lot of places, they don't even have," he was saying, "they don't have food. They don't have grocery stores. They don't have these basic things that we have that many times," and I'm just as much at fault as this as anybody else, "we don't even think about. We just kind of go on, and we're always focused in on ourselves. Anyway, so I do that for a while. I have an aunt who I cherish. She's fabulous. Believe it or not, she is my father's brother's wife. So there is a good side to our family, especially the married inside. They didn't have as many bad genes as we had. And she basically invited, you know, there I was by myself, and she said, you know, I want you to come on vacation with us. So I went off for a week with them, and then she basically hounded me to death until I moved to Atlanta. So I, you know, kind of packed up, you know, my 10 years in Charlotte and all that stuff, and I was coming down here with nothing. And she says as well, when you come here, you can't go get an apartment because you can't afford it, so you can live with us. So there I am at that point. Oh, that was 91. So I was 34, 35, and I'm living with my aunt and uncle. That's not real cool. Especially when you thought you were a big shot and had done, you know, really very well for a while. So anyway, I'm living with them. Eventually, I you know, get a position down here. I move into this apartment, and then I meet this lady who says, you know, she was kind of a self-made matchmaker, and she decides she wants to set me up with all these girls. So she gives me six names. So one night I can remember, and I guarantee you I was drinking, just because I always was drinking. So I remember sitting in my bed in this little one-bedroom apartment, you know, a little cool area of town down at 28th Street. And I can remember, you know, drinking beers and calling, and I was like dialing for dollars, you know, calling these girls. And so I set up with these five girls. And then, of course, I go out with them back to back. And, you know, and you're just, you know, by the time I was a mess anyway. So I'm telling my story, and whether they were good, bad, or indifferent, who knows? But they just, you know, I'm sure they wanted to get out of there as fast as I wanted to get out, you know, get away from them. So, anyway, things are still moving along, and I go up with the five. I couldn't get up with the sixth one. Time goes on. This girl calls me back up. She, of course, she knew what was going on. She said, you know, what about these other girls? I said, well, they were terrible. She said, well, why don't you call us one last girl? I said, no, I'm not calling any of us. Oh, just one last girl. Call me. Call her. So I was actually supposed to go out with her on a Wednesday night, but I decided I was going to be drinking on Wednesday night. So I go out with her on a Thursday night. And once again, you know, maybe this was luck or whatever else. And unfortunately, I heard this may be taped, so hopefully she won't hear this, but actually, as normal, I'm sure I was drinking before I picked her up. But literally, she opened up the door, and that was it. I mean, I can remember exactly what she was wearing. In fact, I was wearing a white T-shirt and black jeans, and she was wearing white jeans and a black T-shirt, and she opened up the door, and the light just, you know, so it took me a while to get that white light experience in AA, but it took me no time to get it with her. And then, you know, I kind of went undercover. I had a lot of friends, kind of like I do now, where I talk to just about every day. I didn't call most of them for a couple, you know, weeks. Guys are calling, they're worried. And literally within a week and 6 days, we were engaged. And fortunately, I'm actually still married to her today. You know, people say, how could you do that in a week and 6 days? And I tell them, look, you know, we didn't want to rush into anything. We want to talk about it a little bit. And any of that, she has been, you know, just phenomenal. And, you know, still to this day, just totally in love with her. But, you know, I think it gets down to kind of like AA is that, you know, you have to, whatever you're going to do well, you have to practice it. You have to think about it all the time. So at least when it comes to her, I think about her all the time. I wasn't always doing the right things, but I think about her. I was also thinking about alcohol all the time, too. So it's, I mean, you know, until you get a focus, it's hard to be successful in anything, especially AA, career, whatever it may be. Anyway, we get married. Yeah, and also I do want you to hear, I was in Atlanta, I went to Athens, then I went back to Atlanta, then I go to Charlotte, then I go back to Atlanta, then I meet my wife, I was in a business, things go sour there, no question the alcohol had something to do with it. Next thing you know, I'm in Memphis, and with her parents. So that I don't get struck by lightning, I'm not going to say much about her parents or her family. Say I still love my wife to death. Some way or another, we made it through 18 painful months there in Memphis. I won't go into the story. It was not good. And it wouldn't have been good if I was sober, and I wasn't. So, anyway, I spent, you know, a bunch of time drinking, and things got just progressively bad. Anyway, I ended up being fired there as well. And then I went off. And really, since I see it's already 8:47, I'm going to kind of move this along. I had a bunch of unbelievable things I was able to accomplish drunk. I started a company that became the largest telecom finance company in the world, unbelievably. Started another, ran a long-distance company. We grew from $20 million to $200 million in less than 18 months. Started a company in Greenville, South Carolina. But I do want you to hear, I went from Memphis now, and then went from Memphis, then went to Columbus, Ohio, and then went from Columbus, Ohio to Philadelphia. You know that geographic change stuff? Kept on messing things up. And then I ended up in Greenville, South Carolina. There, five of us started a company. We went from five of us to 2,200 in 3 years, and we had a valuation of over $1.4 billion. Things did go south there, too. I will say that some of it had to do with my drinking, but most of it wasn't. It was a very challenging time in telecom world, and our investors took that opportunity to take, you know, what we had away from us, which is kind of the venture capital business. You know, if everybody does great, you do great, too, but if the market goes bad, you go bad, and they do great. So, anyway, but the common theme was keep on drinking. Eventually, in 2000, I was supposed to retire, but I left because it still looked like on paper we went from looking like we had a couple $100 million in valuation to our investors basically screwing us all, and now we're down to 15 or 20 million. Still a damn good number. But, And eventually they diluted us out almost, they diluted us out completely. But anyway, my wife comes in one day and basically says, the kids and I are moving to Atlanta. Be nice if you came with us, but we're gone. So I figured maybe I should go follow them, and so we came down here. Now remember, I'm still drinking, and I'm still caught up in fear, and I will tell you, you know, in hindsight, looking back at it, in fact, Dan wanted me to meet John early on, another friend of ours, and he, at some way or another, I end up in this business. That so I still have some cash actually at that time through all this, and I end up in this business that was the strongest industry since the Great Depression, that used to be called the residential construction business. So anybody who's kept their eyes open knows what happened to that. And I actually remember Dan saying, you need to go meet John Wilcox. You know, he knows all the stuff. He's in this industry. And I really, out of fear, I'm sure, I didn't meet him, who could have probably given me some guidance because it was a brand new industry for me. I didn't know what I was doing. And then I got, like a lot of people, been in a wrong place at the wrong time. Anyway, the good part is, that's 2002. 2003, some way or another, I'm supposed to be home for Shabbos dinner on Friday night. As normal, I'm out drinking. I call, and this is normal, you know. Call my wife, I'm not going to be there. And something happened, and it was like, I got to do something about this. So I call the 800 number for AA. They're telling me you need to go downtown. You know, this is one of these areas that I'm definitely not going to go to. And then they start telling me about, well, there's a place on Roswell Road. Well, what's the address? 8111. I'm like, that's like near my house. Yeah, you need to go in there. So I go in there, drunk, of course. I walk in, and if, for those of you who've been over there, there's one of the guys, the mainstay, his name's Harold. And I walk in, as you know, and again, I now have, so see, I think a lot of you guys are not truly real alcoholics because I went in and out. I took 17 years to get back. And you guys that flip in and out, yeah, y'all are not real alcoholics. For me, I had to get out there and do it for quite some time. So I walk in there and basically walk right out. And as I'm walking to my car, this guy comes out and he says, hey, come here, I need to talk to you. As Harold, and he sticks his hand on my shoulder, and he says, it's a Friday night, you don't need to be driving, you call your wife. I'm too embarrassed to call my wife, but he convinced me to do it. And he said, you know, you need to come back tomorrow. This is on a Friday night. You need to come back. I said, okay, maybe I will. So some way or another, I get my butt up, and I come there, and then he tells me, now you need to start taking these guys' phone numbers and putting them in your phone. Now, I didn't want to know any of you guys. I didn't want your phone numbers anywhere near me. I didn't want anything to say, hey. And something happened, and I did, amazingly. So soon thereafter, he introduced me to my sponsor, my first sponsor, who says, you know, you need to go to one of these meetings with me. And I'm thinking we're going to, like, you know, an Amway meeting, so I had no clue. He wants me to go to one of these meetings, and I walk in, and Dan's there and a number of other people. This guy, Dana, who you may know, is there. And they ask, who's your sponsor? And remember, I had chosen the wrong sponsor the first go around, so I'm not going to choose a pastor. I said, you know, well, I haven't chosen one yet. You know, I just want to, you know, wait and figure out the right person. And Dana says, well, who brought you? And I said, well, John did. He said, okay, fine, he's your sponsor. What? So, through that, you know, to kind of move forward, so I don't keep you guys too long. Basically, there have been a lot of things that have happened over the last 7.5 years since I've been. I would tell you, actually, financially, you heard about a lot of the bigs that I had and a lot of the downs. I've actually lost more money sober than I ever did drunk. And I will say, some of it might have been out of fear, but a lot of it happened to be, truthfully, wrong place, wrong time. Wrong industry, things of that sort. But the one, and actually, as I was seeing the last of this fortune I had built going away, it wasn't that long ago that I was totally depressed in my basement, a year and a half, 2 years ago, in my basement. Spent about 6 months writing my wife a letter, detailed everything about, you know, what she needed to do with insurance, because I still had some insurance left. I was concerned I couldn't pay for it. So I did, as far as you can go to getting ready to commit suicide, Dan's told me to get rid of the letter. It's somewhere on the hard drive somewhere. But, I mean, I had all that stuff out. I had my pistol all purchased. I had it all done, you know. And all these things kept on happening. And I will tell you, the reason I'm here today is a couple of things. Number one is the guys sitting here. They were calling me when I needed it. And Anthony, I love Anthony. He would call me and tell me about his bad things going on. You know, I just got this raise, and I'm trying to go travel around here. I got to do all these kind of things. I'm sitting there thinking about killing myself, and he's telling me these things. And I would say, Anthony, you want to trade? And then, you know, as time, and for a long time, I had a terrible resentment against him. But then as I thought about it, I thought, you know, Anthony is giving me what I need. He's not sitting here baiting me. He's telling me about his life. It's not all about me. But it was the guys that are here that kept on reaching out. There's another guy, Craig, that's another long story. But, you know, he's like one of my closest friends. He calls me every day. Anthony calls me every weekend. I always get, doesn't matter, he can be in another country. And Saturday and Sunday, I get a weather report. So all these guys would call me and they'd say, you know, I'm going to keep on calling till you call me back. So some way or another, between that, between my wife finally helped get me to a doctor and I got on some meds, and things have completely changed around. Now, not financially, but my life changed, turned around. I have a terrific marriage. I got the greatest kids in the world, at least for me. And the most important thing I have now is I have a chance. I'm sober, so I have a chance. I'm also alive, so I have a chance. And, you know, I still have, though I'm older now, I have a lot of the God-given talents and skills that were given to me. I surely didn't deserve them, but I have them. And now that I'm, you know, I've been around long enough or, you know, learned some things, I can do this. I would say, as far as AA is concerned, for me, AA is the best gift I've ever been given. I think, look, I adore my wife, but she is a normal person. Now, I never wanted to be normal anyway. I wanted to be above normal, right? I thought I was cool, smart, this, that, and the other, so I didn't want to be normal. A normal person to me, everybody has issues. We have the gift of knowing what our issue is and that we can work on it. And especially with the program, you know, I learned with a lot of beating me in the head that AA is not about alcohol, but it's about a way of life. And so once you get those kind of basic concepts down, it really becomes great because we can do something about it. We can spend a dollar or two to get, you know, to go to a meeting and get counseling, very cheap. And then we learn other things that Dan was really good about teaching me, which is that, you know, we're all caught up with this selfishness. And so Dan has turned that for me into a positive thing. He says that all humans are selfish. And I didn't believe him because I thought it was the greatest guy in the world. And he said, so why do you not run around on your spouse? It's because you want to keep her. And why do you not, you know, why do you come home to your kids? It's not supposed to be because you're trying to be a good father, because you want to see them. So if you turn that around, you can make being selfish a good thing. I know at the end of the day, I'm really up here for me, and I hope you guys get something out of it. I work with all my friends in AA because I get a lot of great things out of it. And so I just want to finalize with this because I'll tell you why I'm here. So there's a guy that was in our men's group, fabulous guy, a former boxer, and he calls me, and he's living on the streets over here. And I did not listen to my mentor, and I went out to go get him by myself. or at least to see where he was. I tried to meet him in a safe place, which I got crap for later. But I end up in this neighborhood. I didn't even know where I was going. So I end up over here. Fortunately, he's now in a program. The guys in our program helped him get there. He got in the CAP treatment center, and now he is in a long-term treatment center. Everything's going great. But I walk in here at 9:30 at night. Remember, I've never told my story. I didn't want to tell my story. So I appreciate you guys being patient with me. But I walk in here, and I'm looking for some help to try to figure out what to do with this buddy of mine and how to get him some help. And there's this guy, Tim Ridgway, right? Tim's last name. He's at 9:30 at night. He's closing up. And I'm there, and I'm saying, hey, this is, you know, so he says, well, you know, I can talk to you about this, that, and the other. I see this picture on the wall, and I say, hey, there's that this buddy of mine. He's like a big deal here now, right? Tim Moy says, that's my sponsor. Oh, my God. Next thing you know, I get this phone call. It says, we'd like you to tell your story. So that's why I'm here. Thank you for letting me be here. Thank you for having, you know, Tim. He's a wonderful guy. I love him to death. And thanks.
Great job. Okay, the seventh tradition. Every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting. Calling outside contributions, our group is supported by your generous contributions, and part of that goes to AA Zone. And I've asked Dan to give out some chips.
Just Dan?
Just Dan.
Thank you very much, Tim. I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic. My name's Dan.
Yeah.
How's everybody? The only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. We designate that desire to stop drinking by asking you to come up and get a white chip. Does anybody have a desire to stop drinking? Any kind of desire, a weak desire. Come on up. Doesn't even have to be a long-term desire. Gets better. It does get better. Anybody else for a white chip? Anybody have 30 days? Nope. 90 days. 6 months. All right.
All right.
I whispered to him, I said, man, that's a long time. He said, tell me about it. Half a lifetime. Anybody else for 6 months? Anybody have 9 months? 9 months. Any year or multiple years? One more time. I hope you know.
All right, good.
Hey, I'm an alcoholic. My name's John. I can't believe it, but it's 25 years. And I know it's a fact. I could have never done it by myself because I tried a bunch of times and I kept getting loaded, you know? And anyway, it's because of y'all. You saved my life. And I got to say one thing, man. When I got here, I hated everybody. I mean, because I hated myself. And today, I can't think of anybody I hate. And I got a lot of friends and a lot of people I love. And it's just, it's because of the program. So thanks a lot.
Thank you, John. Congratulations. Anybody else for a year or 25, 30 years? Wow. Anybody? Another shot on white chip. Anybody want to join this way of life? Desire to stop drinking? Weak desire? Any kind of desire? Thank y'all for letting us be here. Love you. Thank you.
That sounds good. Okay, do we have any AA-related announcements? Yes, Mark.
name is Mark from Alcoholics.
Hey, Mark.
I have a pizza in the cabin. If anyone would like any English, just give me a chance.
Thank you, Mark. Yes, Tim.
I'm Tim, I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Tim.
Thanks to all our visitors for being here. Next Monday night, Bill Sanders and the 11 Minute Workshop is telling the story.
Hey.
Yeah, if you survive the weekend, come back in here. You get keep going. It'll be great. And then the week after that, we have Jeremy C. from the Biscayne Last Resort Group. Jeremy is he's here frequently. So a lot of people, a lot of you may know Jeremy, but he's got a heck of a story as well. And things are looking good through Gene. So, if you know, Monday night, you always count on us to be here for you. Okay, so any other announcements? I'd like to remind everybody that anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities. For those who will, please join us in the Lord's Prayer. Tinsley, could you take us out, please?
Repeat this over.
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, power, and glory, forever and ever. Amen.
Think you can make it the rest of the day?
Oh, yes, sir.
Awesome.
Good.
Well, I hope we helped out a little bit.
Yeah, you can do that.
Yeah, I have. Thanks for keeping this going, man. I really enjoyed speaking to you.
Oh, great. Thank you.
Hey, Justin.
Hey, how you doing?
The man.
Are you still on recording?
All right, so you're... Oh, yeah. Let's say we got to stop that.
Anybody got a pen?
Yeah, I do.